Tonight on Arena, we review the Bob Dylan biopic, A Complete Unknown, and we preview the Irish famine musical, Celtic Exodus. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Thursday night is, of course, film night. And we have John McGuire and Arlene Hunt, and they've been to see A Complete Unknown and also Wolfman. But before we came to air, we heard of the very sad news of the death of David Lynch, director of Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, TV's Twin Peaks and The Elephant Man. He died at the age of 78. Let's listen to David first, talking about career versus art.
There's no launching a career. You know, they call it a film business, but money is the last thing a person should be thinking about in my book. The last thing. You fall in love with ideas and you get fired up and you go and you try to translate those ideas into cinema. And it's a beautiful, beautiful journey. And so it has nothing to do with any kind of career. It has to do with the loving of doing.
The great David Lynch there, whose death was announced today. John, there was no doubt he was an artist, not a career man.
He was an artist indeed. I'm terrible sorry to hear this news. Kay, just before we came on air there, we found out that at the age of 78, this David Lynch is dead, which is terrible. But no more David Lynch films or TV, which is even worse.
Now, he exploded onto the screens with Eraserhead,
yeah,
which was such an unusual, unnarrative film.
Yeah, but this is the thing with Lynch and throughout all of his work in life, is that he would present you with these visions, these ideas, these surreal, strange images, and he would challenge you to put them together. And I can't think of another American filmmaker that has operated in the same kind of way. He was inspired by Louis Buñuel after art school in Philadelphia. He wanted to make films. He made a couple of short films. Eraserhead was the first of them. Mel Brooks saw Eraserhead and gave him the job of directing The Elephant Man, which is to me one of the great films of the American 20th century in American cinema. Really an extraordinary film and a great tribute to him. And then he got hooked up with Dino De Laurentiis, and he made a disastrous effort at Dune, which I quite admired, actually, when I saw it, but it was a flop. But the two film deal that he made with De Laurentiis, he went on to make one of his greatest achievements, which is Blue Velvet, which was the real breakthrough for him. That was an international film, and it gave him the opportunity to make loads and loads of films. When you look at the list of films that he made, Mulholland Drive, I'm drawing a blank now, Kate. The Twin Peaks, I suppose, in the 90s, Twin Peaks was a sensation, but that was for the first season. The second season, not so much. And there was an appetite for Lynch in the 1990s that came and went, but it didn't stop him from doing exactly what he wanted to do. Fire Walk With Me, his Twin Peaks film, that is an extraordinary film, which is, and a lot of the films that
Wild
he released
Heart,
at the time, Wild at Heart, a super
Nicolas
movie.
Cage, yeah, with yes,
Nicolas Cage,
yeah.
And Laura Dern.
Yeah.
All the way up to Inland Empire, I suppose, and the second Twin Peaks that he made, which again was another sensation.
And he did The Straight Story, which was a very straight choice for David Lynch.
Well, I think The Straight Story was a challenge to him, but it really, The Straight Story spoke, I think, to his childhood in Missoula, Montana, and the kind of the Eagle Scout, the kind of outdoor life that he had led, the farming, rural upbringing that he had had. His father worked for the Department of Energy, and he was into hunting and fishing and bringing them outside. And I think The Straight Story was really a film about his own childhood and the kind of people that he knew when he was younger, very far from the Hollywood kind of movies that he made. But an extraordinary film, you know, and every film, every TV thing, every music video he made, every painting, every photograph. He used to have a little snippet where he'd do the weather on the internet, and he'd sit in his office in LA and look out the window and tell you what the weather was. Even that was extraordinary. It was everything that he touched had that unique Lynchian vision about.
Were you a fan, Arlene?
Yeah, I was the right age for Twin Peaks, the original Twin Peaks. And it was one of those things that because back then you didn't stream things. You saw it once a week. So we'd wait patiently once a week to watch it and then just talk about it nonstop the next day and try to figure out what was happening with the lady with the log and what could this mean. And, it was just so complicated, especially for teenage minds. We just couldn't get our heads around what we were seeing and then trying to figure it out. He was amazing.
Let's listen to a clip of one of the earlier films that John spoke about there, Elephant Man. Here, Anthony Hopkins plays Frederick, the surgeon and the only friend, really, of John Merrick, played by John Hurt, who is the Elephant Man.
How do I look?
Splendid. Well, you will not look out of place. You look absolutely splendid.
Oh, splendid. Shall we go?
Yes. Again, I can't tell you how sorry I am for what happened. You see, I had no idea. Really.
Please, you mustn't blame yourself. It's the trees. Don't worry about me, my friend. I am happy every hour of the day. My life is full because I know that I am loved. Again to myself. I could not say that were it not for you.
Well, and you've done so much for me as well. Thank you.
It's still so touching, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's such a tender
break
film,
your heart.
Yeah. A film about humanity. And yes. I think you could find that thread in a lot. Yes, they were violent. Yes, they were strange. Yes, they were surreal. Sometimes he was just baiting you in the audience. But there's a great humanity in all of his work. There are identifiable characters that you really find yourself rooting for in almost every film that he made. Yeah.
And he was also an actor. He played John Ford in Steven Spielberg's
Meet the Fablemans. Yes. That's right. It's actually quite a good scene. But John Ford is a difficult man to play, I'd imagined, and he did it perfectly. He had the sort of tone down and dismissiveness down. Everything was down. It was just perfect. He was perfect for it. Mm.
And then he did this strange film about him interviewing a monkey in What Jack Did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the little short, these doodles that he would come out with now and again, these little short things. I mean, he also had a comic strip for a long time called The Angriest Dog in the World, which was just the same four panels. In LA Weekly, a magazine in Los Angeles, then he did that for years. The same four panels that he had drawn himself with a different caption every week. And define that for me, Kay. Define any of these things for me. It's almost impossible. And the challenge that you have when you're watching Lynch, I cannot think right now of somebody else in the ecosphere, in cinema, that is asking you to interpret their work in quite the same way, that is deliberately challenging you, presenting you with mysteries, and then abandoning you, leaving you entirely to yourself to figure it out. And that is such an energizing force in cinema, particularly when you're sitting in the audience.
And to be superficial, he had amazing hair.
That is pretty superficial, but he did have amazing hair. Yeah.
Lush
he kept it
and
all
vertical.
Throughout his life. Yeah, all his life. Yeah.
OK, well, we're so sorry to hear that of the death of David Lynch at the very young age of 78. You would think he had many, many more films to make. In moving on to Arena Movie Reviews tonight, two men on the cusp of change, one from folk troubadour to electric hero, or maybe to being a Judas, and the other from human to flesh-eating hairy creature. In a complete unknown, Timothy Chalamet gives us Bob Dylan, a young musician on the New York folk scene as he decides to turn his back on acoustic and beware the full moon. In Wolfman, an encounter with a toothy monster leaves Christopher Abbott going through a horrific transformation. As I said, John McGuire and Arlene Hunt have been to see these. And where else to start with a complete unknown? The film is directed by James Mangold, a dab hand at the music biopic after a success of the very awardsy Johnny Cash film, Walk the Line. This time round, Bob Dylan is the focus of attention. John Timothy Chalamet takes on the role of Dylan, songs and all, singing the songs.
He sings the songs, yeah. This is Timothy Chalamet. He goes from playing an interstellar messiah in Villeneuve's Dune to a kind of a reluctant earthbound messiah, I suppose, a god of the folk scene in a complete unknown, which is the biopic of the origins and rise to fame of Dylan in the 1960s Greenwich Village folk scene. Very tightly focused, Kay, over the first 4 years of that scene from 1961 to 65. It starts with him arriving, hitchhiking to New York as a 19-year-old to visit his idol Woody Guthrie, who's played by Scoot McNairy, who's in hospital. Looking for the spark. Is that what he says, Arlene? If I want to catch a spark, is what
catch
says.
A spark. He wants catch to catch a spark.
And hoping then we go then, we follow Dylan on and off through these 4 years up to the 1965 Newport Folk Festival, where, like you say, he goes electric, as they say. And I suppose the film is an attempt to reconcile the young Dylan's ambitions and his sincerity and his obvious talent, his facility with words, his beautiful guitar, with and that single-mindedness that he brings to all of that, while cataloguing these triumphs and betrayals, his infidelity, his own ambition and his urge to break out of the box that the folk guys want to keep him in as their hero. And that's what we're watching throughout the film.
What kind of Greenwich Village do we get from James Mangold?
Well, it's a time of change. It's a time of change. It's a time of civil liberties. It's a time of people, you know, there's war in the air. There's the possibility of nuclear war in the air. It's everything is in flux. And when he arrives there, you know, he's coming from, you know, sort of a rural background, and he's in the city because he said he wants to catch a spark of something, but it's also something he believes in. He believes very strongly in, you know, adding a voice. He didn't want to do rock and roll because rock and roll was available and rock and roll was like the big thing at the time. But he felt rock and roll didn't actually speak to the people the same way as folk music spoke to people. So he was really, really wanted to represent what was going on in the world around him. I liked this film a lot.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I really liked. And what I liked about it a lot is that they don't try to whitewash Bob's personality in it. You know, he's prickly. He's disloyal. He's a bit of a cad when it comes to the ladies, say. You know, he's all of these things, but he's also extremely talented, and he makes no apology about that. And that's an interesting way that they have portrayed him, in that he makes no apology to anyone, whether it's the people of Newport, you know, the festival organizers, or Seeger, you know, Pete Seeger, who has been his great champion, or Joan Baez, who's, you know, both a lover and a contemporary. She was as famous as him in the early days, and maybe more so.
More so, yeah.
Yeah, more so.
And we know that Bob Dylan was a huge myth maker when he came to New York. He told lots of fibs about his early life, and he was having an affair with Joan Baez, which is played by Monica Barbaro, while he has a relationship with his very sweet girlfriend. In this scene, it's the morning after the night before, and she challenges him about some of his myth making.
Who taught you to play?
Well, I taught myself, really. Picked up a few licks at the carnival.
At the carnival?
Oh, yeah, they were singing cowboys that come through, teach me all sorts of funny chords. And they passed through in the shows in Kansas or Dakotas. Yeah, these chords I learned from a cowboy named Wigglefoot.
You were in a carnival. You are so completely full of shit. I had lessons as a kid, you know, normal lessons. I write too. I'm not sure there's a way to learn that.
Too hard.
Excuse me?
You tried too hard to write.
Really?
Yeah, if you're asking.
I wasn't.
Sunsets and seagulls, smell of buttercups. Your songs are like an oil painting at the dentist's office.
You're kind of an asshole, Bob.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
See? An unapologetic asshole.
Oh, she has him there. She has him. Yeah, she caught him. Yeah, she did. Yeah, she
so,
did.
So that is true that when he came to New York, he was peddling all these old stories about his past.
I believe so. I don't know about Wigglefoot now. I'm not sure if Wigglefoot, the singing cowboy, ever existed. But I think Dylan invented himself, you know. And when you're thrown in, like Seeger, the character played by Edward, beautifully played by Edward Norton here, is this kind and generous folksy hippie, kind of proto-hippie character.
Kind of half preacher, half... Yeah, half,
exactly,
yeah.
And takes him into his home, introduces him to all of Greenwich Village, makes him into a star, gets him a manager, does all of these things, and ultimately by the end of the film is completely betrayed by Bob Dylan.
Yes, but so you say, Arlene, he did believe in folk music.
Oh, he believed, and he wasn't into rock music at that time. He just didn't think rock music was the way to get a message across to people because there was so much change. He thought rock was a bit light, whereas he always said folk music was more true. It was truer. You spoke about how people actually were and how they thought and what impact you could have through a folk song was more than what you could get through a rock song. And so he really believed in
mind. How does that come across,
well, this is the minor criticisms that I have about this film is that there is a gap here right in the middle where we go from, let's say, late 62 to early 64. And something's changed and we don't know what it is.
I mean, thought that's what the film was about.
Well, not really. It brings us to a point and then it gives us a gap in time when suddenly he's got a motorbike and a leather jacket and a surly attitude and his hair is longer and he's writing darker songs.
And he has no tolerance anymore for like Bob.
Exactly. He's become famous. Yes. This is it. It's a film really that addresses the difficulty that young artists have in dealing with their own celebrity is part of what the film is about. I mean, it's about a lot of things and Dylan is about a lot of things and I'm no Dylanologist by any means. But there is this gap where suddenly we have new characters. We have a Hammond organ player, an electric guitarist, yeah. And there's kind of hums and haws. The folk people don't like it.
And he makes a point of saying that he wants new musicians to work with.
He wants to evolve. It's really this absolute urge. He's left the folk people behind, even though they're not aware of it yet. And he wants to evolve. He wants to push himself forward. And he's still writing extraordinary songs. And that's... Okay, when it boils down to it, this is what the film does best, is that Chalamet is singing and playing these songs himself. He's playing them to audiences who are hearing them for the first time. And that allows us to hear them for the first time. And that is an extraordinary trick that the film plays.
Okay, I think we should play Timothy Chalamet singing one of those Bob Dylan songs as Bob Dylan. This is Girl from the North Country.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to the one who lives there. For she once was a true love mine. If you go with snowflake storm, when the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she wears her coat so warm to keep her from the howling wind.
Monica Barbaro as Joan Baez and Timothy Chalamet as Bob Dylan. I mean, the success of the film does rely so much on Timothy Chalamet. How do you think he does, Arlene?
I think he was handed something that was really difficult to do and I think he pulled it off. I'm not sure he has the exact nasally twang of Bob Dylan, but then I imagine that's really, really difficult to do. But the fact that he grew his nails long. He learned how to play a guitar. He learned how to sing in that style. He spoke very carefully to the wardrobe assistant. You know, I saw him being interviewed and he said, like, my clothes when I come to New York, I don't want clothes that look like they just came straight out of store. I wanted beaten up jackets and the old hat and everything else. He has gone from, as John said earlier, from Dune, which is intergalactic space lord, and he has absolutely embodied Bob Dylan as much as he physically can and as much as he can, you know, through song and through everything else. And I thought he was great. I thought he was really believable.
Oh, me too. I think it's much less of an impersonation than it is an impression, if you get my meaning, that he's trying to embody this character rather than do a kind of a campfire student party Bob Dylan impression. It's deeper than that. And I think what comes out throughout for Chalamet is that creativity that he is. We know these songs, they're anthems, everybody knows them, you could sing line by line, and when he's writing them, when he's singing them for the first time, or when he's picking over them, when he's sitting at the typewriter, there's a very Dylan-esque part of that, where there's just reams and reams of this stuff flowing out of him, and I think he channels that extremely well.
Arlene, Bob Dylan did give his own approval to the script here.
He did.
There are some changes that he asked for. I think it was around the character of Sylvie Russo, which is based on his girlfriend at the time. That was Suze Rotolo.
Yeah.
So, but still, as you say, it's giving a warts and all kind of view of Dylan.
Yeah.
So do you think Dylan was open to this kind of reassessment of him?
I think his personality was signing checks that he was able to cash. That's what I think. He was that talented. He was able to do great things. He doesn't pretend to be something he's not. He really doesn't. And certainly in this film, he doesn't at any point pretend to be something he's not. And he's willing to go up against, you know, friends, and he's willing to go up against foe alike. So I think I can understand why Bob Dylan, you know, in particular, like there's nothing in this that he would shy away from.
No, good. And I think that slipperiness about factuality and, you know, the definitives, there are contractions, there are fabrications, but that slipperiness is very appropriate for Dylan, and that it invites myriad interpretations is also very Dylan-esque. And I think Dylan's refusal to be defined by genre, to be defined as a folk singer, I think that comes through very strongly, again, in this very tightly focused 4-year gap. And I'd love to see a Chalamet and Mangold. You could make a Dylan film about every 4 years. You could do the motorbike crash. You could do the conversion to Christianity. You could do the tours in the 1970s. You could do the wilderness of the 1980s, his reinvention in the 90s, all the way up to the Nobel Prize. You could have a Dylan cinematic universe.
We should have one episode for the We Are the World.
Or the Traveling Wilburys.
He's been dropped into
you
the
could
middle
do
of
a, make a movie about any 4-year period in Dylan's life, and it would just be just as fascinating.
Can we give watch a massive, those as well?
Yes, but can we give a massive shout out to Boyd Holbrook?
He plays Johnny Cash here.
Everyone would know him from Narcos.
He was the other FBI guy.
He was so much fun in this film. Yeah, I didn't recognize him. I genuinely did not recognize. I couldn't figure out who the actor was for so long.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah, I was looking at him thinking, who is this guy?
How do I know this guy?
For Mangold to go at Cash again and to do it again and to be even better this time.
Oh,
he's
so
only
fun.
Got four scenes and he absolutely blows
away.
Scene
stealer. He's great.
Okay, a Stars out of 5 4 A Complete Unknown.
I gave it 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great, but 4 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, 4 for me too. There is just this gap that I couldn't get over that's very slightly dented the film for me, but I think Chalamet is superb here and I think Mangold has done a brilliant job.
Now, in Wolfman, Christopher Abbott and Julia Garner play a couple, Blake and Charlotte, who are isolated in rural Oregon with their child as Blake starts to experience illness and, worryingly, transformation. Arlene, the film begins with a preamble. Is that back into the Wolfman myth so that we know?
No, it's not. No, it isn't. The film begins with 30 years ago. And it's a very young Blake is out with his father, who's an ex-army guy and who's obviously some kind of prepper. You know, he's very isolated from the world. The cabin that they live in is very remote. It's set in Oregon, very remote Oregon. There's signs everywhere like, you know, there's nothing in here worth breaking in for because you'll get killed and just, you know, everything. So he has his son. He's very hard on his son. The dad is, you know, he has him up and everything is military precision. The bed has to be made. He gives these numbers at 0800 hours. We're going here. We're this. And so there's no warmth towards the boy at all. But while they're out on an excursion, they're hunting and he and his father are out hunting and they're after a deer. You know, they're going to stock up their freezers and stuff like that. But something attacks them in the woods. Now, you don't see what it is, and they eventually run away and they hide up in a hide, you know, for a deer hide, and they're up a ladder. But something is so physical, you don't see it, but you physically hear it and you sense it. There's like something monstrous is chasing after them. But at the end, it gets distracted and it goes away. And then, you know, then we go back then straight away from that, where we're in New York 30 years later, where he is now a stay-at-home husband in between jobs, and he's raising his own daughter, and he's estranged from his father, or has been estranged from his father for many, many years. His wife, Charlotte, is a journalist. She's the one doing all the work and bringing home all the money, and he's a stay-at-home dad. And he learns that his father, who had been missing for several years, has finally been declared dead by the state of Oregon. And so it's up to him to go back up to the house and finish off the last of the house and pack up his dad's things. And because his marriage is, we'll say, fragile, he suggests to his wife that she come with him and with their daughter, and, you know, maybe they have a family time together. And though now we have the family heading off into the very rural Oregon, where something lurks.
Okay, so I guess that's the Wolfman. How does the Wolfman appear?
Well, the first hint we get of it, like Arlene says, up mm-hmm. in the deer blind, is you just see steam, literally breath, steam from behind them. And that's quite effective, actually. And
especially when it was behind them.
Exactly, especially when it turns up behind them. And we don't want to spoil the whole thing. And it's fairly easy to spoil this because there's not an awful lot here. But once we get back to Oregon, and the character played by Christopher Abbott, Blake, the writer, is an older man, a man of middle age with his own family. As soon as they arrive, literally as soon as they arrive, they are attacked by a creature on the road, knocks the truck off the road, and the chase starts then. And from, we've had a 30-year build-up to a film that from that point takes place over the course of a single night, as this monster chases them around. Turns Blake's character is infected. It's not the moon so much as a kind of a post-COVID film in that it is an infection, and turns him into the wolf face, as the Native Americans call it, turns him into a wolf man. So the character played by Julia Garner, Charlotte the journalist, has to deal with the threat that's outside the house, and then suddenly this threat that's inside the house, try to keep herself and her daughter safe from two monsters.
Oh, sounds good.
No, it was good when you couldn't see the monster. Is that it?
That's right. Good, yeah.
When you don't see, this is the Jaws effect for me. When you hear the music and you sense that something underneath the water is coming towards you, it's always more terrifying than when you actually see the thing. And for me, Blake, as a character, there's a lot of really strange things. He's grown up in this environment where you think, his father says to him at one point, you know, you've got to take care of who you're with because, you know, you can lose somebody at any moment. And the very first thing we see when they get to Oregon is that he stops and lets a creepy neighbour into his car with his wife and child, who's, by the way, heavily armed, leering at his wife and child and saying some really questionable things. He's like, hey, hop on in, show us where my dad's property is. Like, there's a whole lot of stupid stuff in this film that made my eyebrows go funny.
Okay, so there is no CGI in this film. It's practical.
So we're told the transformation effects, the creature effects, are practical effects, which is to be commended. We don't see that very often anymore, and it makes a massive difference, Gay, when you're watching that the special effects technicians have actually built these prosthetics. They have made these mechanics. They've allowed us to see it, you know, as real, as opposed to some kind of crappy CGI thing. And that has a huge effect. And Lee Whannell, the director here, and his entire SFX team are to be commended for that. But effects on their own can't stand on their own. You have to have a story around them. And that's where this is a cardboard story. There's nothing here whatsoever. And I suppose where the point here, as he did when he addressed toxic masculinity and the Me Too movement in his previous film, The Invisible Man, through Elizabeth Moss, which was a superb thriller. What I suppose he's looking at here is fatherhood and the issues that we have around fatherhood, modern fatherhood, and that kind of authoritarian, domineering character that we meet at the start of the film. But it kind of stops there. There is no development. None of the characters are really developed at all. And for a character like Charlotte, who's supposed to be this intelligent journalist, who's played by one of the best actors working today, Julia Garner, who's a superb actor. And she, you know, after the merest thumbnail sketch of a character, is just left to scream for the rest of the movie. I think it's so disappointing that they couldn't find anything for her to do.
Stars out of five for you, Arlene.
Oh, hold on now. Let me find out what I went with. I said, oh, I gave it 2 out of 5. I thought it was very middle of the road.
Okay, and from you, John?
2 for me, Kay. I think it's only half a movie, really, and it feels very blunt. It's kind of an anecdote and unspecified, scarcely connected to the real world.
There are a couple of jump scares.
There are some very good jump scares
in it. And I will say, the reason I gave it the 2 points is because when it's told from the wolf's perspective,
and
there are some scenes
it
changes the whole movie. I just wish there'd been more of that in it.
Yeah, it's a disappointment, unfortunately.
Well, Wolfman and A Complete Unknown go on general release tomorrow. John McGuire and Arlene Hunt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kay.
Thanks, Kay.
A new musical called Celtic Exodus will open next week at the Complex Arts Theatre in Dublin. It's a project that started out in 1994 when Brian Warfield of the Wolf Tones set out to tell the story of Ireland and the famine through music, song and dance. 1 year ago, producer Larry Bass of Sin Éil and John Murphy took on the project. They adapted Warfield's script, brought director Mark Lambert and Riverdance veteran Jason O'Neill on as choreographer. So the Warfield story of the Irish famine will finally premiere on January 23rd. To tell us more about this project, I'm joined in studio by the producer of Celtic Exodus, John Murphy, and choreographer Jason O'Neill. So John, as I said, this is a passion project of Brian Warfield of the Wolf Tones. He's telling of the Irish famine in music and story. And then you took it on.
Yes.
So what did you get? Did you get a script? Did you get the music? What did you get?
I got a script of epic proportions, I think it's fair to say. And I got the music. Set in the famine, which makes you stop and think for a minute. I wasn't immediately convinced, but I started to have a look at it. And it's a story we don't tell. Musicals are something we don't make very often. They take a huge investment. They take an awful lot of work. And our record is a varying success, I guess. But I listened to the story and it's set in a famine. Doesn't make it a famine story completely. It's actually a beautiful love story carrying through all this. And it finds an Ireland before the famine, which is certainly an untold story, where people still loved and still danced and still sang and survived. Times were very hard, but it wasn't a dismal world until the famine came and took everything away from them. And that comes through throughout the show, before and after, in Act 1 and Act 2. But the music, I listened to the music, and it's by a renowned folk singer, somebody who's been telling stories for 40 years, but I never expected the theatrical muscle I'd find inside the music. It just grabs you, and you can visualise staging of it, and you can visualise choreographers and dancers. So I eventually took it on, but I asked if I could bring my whole team in, and they said yes. Brian said yes in particular. So I went looking for people who I thought would make this musical theatre. One was a guy called Ross Scanlon, who is...
Musical director.
Yeah, and he's a specialist in Sondheim. And actually, the marriage between a Sondheim specialist and the folk music of Brian Warfield, who wrote several songs for Wolf Tones, it comes as something original, something hugely unique.
And what did Brian think about you messing with his baby, his passion project?
He was great. He was great. He wrote something that was enormous. There were 41 people in it, and it was nearly 3 hours long. And I had to explain that we couldn't do that, and I had to adapt it. And he was fully supportive of it. You know, I used his music, I used his tracks. We've done things with it that he probably wouldn't have even imagined could be done. And I also, dancing was a theme through it. The community was held together by dancing. So I thought, well, in for a penny, who's the best guy I could go to for this? And Jason, you know, who's choreographing it. He's storytelling through dance, and he brought the dancers in with him.
So, Jason, you are a veteran, as we said, of Riverdance, and Celtic Exodus is set in 1845, the beginning of the terrible potato blight that led, obviously, to the Irish famine. And the story begins with a dance competition. Tell us a little bit about the dance competition, who's involved, and then how you went about choreographing it.
That's right. It starts with the dance competition, and I thought, I'm the best man for this job. I've been dancing competitions my whole life. So I knew that kind of camaraderie, the kind of going back and forth with someone, trying to compete, and that energy. So we started from the very start, trying to build those characters about who they were, why they were dancing, why they were jovial, why they had different emotions. And building those characters started to build this idea of like this dance-off and then this competition. And then it led to, I'm not going to tell you too much about what actually happens, but it leads to a scene with a bit of drama. And from that drama unfolds this quite poignant story of two families that are kind of feuding in the backdrop of the famine.
Yes, and right. Ned and Dan are the two people involved in the dance-off.
Right.
And what happens at the dance-off starts a feud that goes down, unfortunately,
through the years.
Through the years and, yeah. and through the generations. Did you have any reservations about making a musical about the famine, John, given the terribleness of that period in our life?
Yeah, some I did. You know, I remember Angela's Ashes, which was a very fine musical, but it was set in a depression. It was set in very harsh domestic circumstances, although it wasn't. It wasn't it was a cheery piece. It was an entertaining piece. So I wanted to make sure this is a musical first. I mean, Brian had his story. I wanted to make it a musical first and a document on the famine afterwards. And I thought we could do it. I thought if we got the right people, we could do it. We need an Irish musical, I think. You know, people go down to the O2 to see wonderful plays. I just saw Mary Poppins. But I want Irish musicals up there too. I want banners next to them. And this could be. It could be. And, you know, we're launching this for the fans. This is a chance for fans to see it first. We may have bigger
sets. You mean fans of The Wolf Tones?
Fans of Irish musicals.
And fans
of Irish
musicals.
Fans of Irish musicals.
Yes.
I want to bring them all down.
So we're going to listen to a piece of music now. So we heard about Dan and Ned falling out, but the love story is between the children of Dan and Ned, which
Correct.
Is That's Sean right. and Siobhan. And we're going to play this track, What Lies Ahead. Do you want it? This is a demo track now. This isn't from
the actual
production.
Yes,
but tell us, am I right? They're the two. They're not meant for each other because Siobhan is betrothed to somebody else.
Yes.
But she meets Sean, who is a white boy who is fighting against the evil British regime.
Yes, he's a rebel on the run when we meet him. It's the Hatfield and McCoy is the feud. This is a forbidden love, but of course you can't keep people away from each other. They're played by a guy we brought in from London called Dennis Grindle and a newcomer called Aoife Fitzpatrick, who is quite frankly astonishing. And this is a duet where they are looking to start a new life together and they're wondering what awaits them.
Every star that ever shone is shining on us now. Every start for every heart that beats will show us how. So take my hand, you love of mine, and I will keep you safe. For every dream that we have dreamed before us lies in wait. What lies ahead? So many dreams, so many reasons to be a dream. What lies ahead? Just like everyone that's come and gone was lived.
What Lies Ahead there from Celtic Exodus, a new Irish musical which will be in the Complex in Dublin from January 23rd. And I'm here with the choreographer, Jason O'Neill, and the producer, John Murphy. So Sean is one of the people in that duet, Jason.
That's right.
So he too is a dancer.
Sean can do everything. So Sean in the show is a dancer. He's a rebel on the run, and he's just a son of he's a son of someone who's quite powerful in the story. And Siobhan is also a bit of a dancer too. They find each other and they dance together. And I'm not going to tell you again what really happens, but they find their way to a new hope and a new life with each other.
And how then, you are the choreographer, we
yes.
heard that duet there, but you like to incorporate the choreography into the story and into the music?
I think the story and the characters really inform my choreography decisions. So when I came into this, I was quite blind. I had a track or two. I obviously knew about the Wolftones and some of their incredible music. I knew they were trailblazers. I knew they were storytellers. So I came in with my Irish dancing background, which is all about rhythm and precision and synchronicity. And I thought, how can I bring in some of that, but then bring in the feeling and the sensitivity of their music? And the more I read the script and the more I watched those actors bring it to life and the more I talked to John and Ross and Mark Lambert, that I could see there's so much depth in this. And the more deeper I got into the story and the characters and the more I believed in them, the more my kind of movement changed. And now it's become, there's a language throughout the show. There's a movement language that we've kind of created ourselves. There's the music, there's the lyrics, there's the acting. And now the dance has become embedded in this story. And I'm so proud of what we're creating. And I really believe that it's one, it's a team.
John, it is about the Irish famine, so obviously there's this horrible vista ahead of the characters that we're watching. We all know what's going to happen if we know our history. But there's also, if there is a villain in the piece, it's a man called Hugh MacWilliams. Who
yes.
is he?
Yeah. He's a land agent. He represents the authorities. He represents greed. He represents a 19th century version of corporate greed, I suppose, if we look deeply into it. He is in a land he has no respect for. He has is in a people he has no respect for. And he has a belief that the famine was God's will and that the Irish people deserved it and let the chips fall where they may.
Yes, and even the people we think he might side with, he seems to have no time for any of the Irish characters.
No, he doesn't. No, he regards them as savages, I suppose, you know, going back to Cromwell's day in a large respect. And he's just a man who lacks compassion, probably isn't a very happy creature himself and probably wishes he was back home.
Now, the musical is called Celtic Exodus. So we feel that there may be an exodus, a move away from Ireland. There might be some chance of getting on a ship, getting away from the horrors of the famine. And the final track is called Thank God for America. So obviously, we won't say who's going because I don't want to spoil it, John, but tell us about this final track. This is the finale.
This is one of the songs that brought me to the show. It is an enormous show-stopping finale. And the track you're going to hear is the demo, but we have put the choreography, the entire chorus of some very, very powerful singers into it. And it's a huge, rousing, hopeful finale to it. Hopeful finale to a story that really, if we look at it, is about a displaced people who have to leave their homes and go and look for a home somewhere else. I'm very happy to tell that story at the moment.
And Jason, what did you do in the finale? What can you tell us? I know you don't want to tell us too much. You're very
I'm very good, but I knew that song was so huge and I wanted to end on something high. But also I knew the whole story was about a journey and departure. So we wanted those themes of like leaving home, setting up a new life, but then landing somewhere with a bit of hope, landing somewhere that you're not sure of, but also that has potential to be something amazing. And the song is really upbeat and it has a lot of rhythm. So I added rhythm, we added syncopated movement, we added people and characters coming. Just this idea of getting off a ship, getting off a boat into a new land. So we wanted something big, something rising. And I think we've got there.
So let's listen and see. Thank God for America is the finale from Celtic Exodus. We'll hear a little of it now.
Across the new horizons, far away from the bitter sea. They left the homes in Ireland, no more the land to see, and made their way up over the land and found a home for Sacramento, to California, North Dakota, South Dakota, Michigan, Oregon, Massachusetts, and Wisconsin, Maine. Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Indiana, Alaska, Utah, Iowa, Ottawa, Omaha, Idaho, New Mexico. Minnesota, Arizona, Carolina, Northern, South Nevada, Nebraska, Mississippi, and Missouri.
Thank God for America, for your country and your fair class shows. Thank God for America, for we love this land forevermore. Each city, each county, all the wonders that we see. We're all part of America, this land that's part of you and me. Thank God for America.
That's Thank God for America, part of the finale of Celtic Exodus. And my thanks to the producer, John Murphy, and the choreographer, Jason O'Neill. Celtic Exodus, the new Irish musical, will run at the Complex Theatre in Dublin from the 22nd to the 25th of January. And booking information can be found at thecomplex.ie. A young British musician, composer and conductor, Leo Geyer, while on a visit to the site of the death camps of Auschwitz, discovered fragments of a musical score in the archives that has opened up the stories of gifted musicians who were damned to enter the camps during World War II. A New Sky Arts documentary, The Lost Music of Auschwitz, traces Leo's discovery of these musical scores and, through first-hand testimonies of survivors, gives us new insights into the concentration camps. And I'm delighted to be joined by Leo Geyer now. Leo, you were in Auschwitz researching a very different project, and then it was the archivist who brought your attention to these just fragments of musical scores.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And it was when I had a conversation with him that he mentioned in a somewhat offhand way that there were musical manuscripts in the depth of the archive, which is something I couldn't really believe, because most items in Auschwitz were completely destroyed by the Nazis as they tried to hide their crimes. So I assumed that to be the case with the music and also the instruments. But it transpires that this was in fact not the case, and that there was indeed a selection of musical manuscripts, albeit none of them complete, many of them damaged with burnt edges or ripped corners and in faded pencil. But there was music, and that is what I've spent the best part of the last decade to try and piece together.
Yes, because one element of the documentary, The Lost Music of Auschwitz, is this kind of detective work you do, trying to find the name of the composer of one set of fragments from these compositions.
Yes, exactly. And this was the composition that really caught my eye on that very first day. And it was a unsigned, unfinished sketch. And on the top, it said Daremne Żale, which translates from Polish as futile regrets. And what really struck me was not the fact that the composition was wracked in grief and sorrow, but actually it was the handwriting, because the handwriting was identical to mine. And consequently, I felt it was my duty to finish it.
Yes, and that has a very wonderful end to the documentary and the story. But there are many other stories of music in the concentration camp. If we could talk about, obviously, the majority of people there were of Jewish heritage, but there was a strong element of Romani people who were in the camps. And you talk a lot about Jakob Sager, who was a wonderful fiddle player. And you composed a piece in his honour. But tell us a little bit about his arrival at the camp.
Yes, so Jakob Sager was a Romani violinist, and like all incoming prisoners to Auschwitz, they were stripped of their belongings and clothes. And Jakob could not bear to be parted with his violin, so he literally gave a performance for his life, stark naked outside the train depot. And in this instance, he was indeed saved from being taken immediately to the gas chamber. And he was taken into the orchestra. And one of the most incredible things was that he was actually unable to read music. But if someone played him the melody once, he would play it back perfectly. And therefore, he was described in many testimonies as one of the best violinists that the orchestra had. And so in his honour, I decided to write a solo violin piece, which was performed in Auschwitz itself, most likely in the exact same spot where he was initially disembarked from on the train.
Now, again, there was a number of orchestras in the camps, and one of the orchestras was an all-woman orchestra. And as you said, you couldn't find, I don't think there are any written scores or of the women's orchestra, but one woman was able to, again, memorise one of the scores.
Yes, exactly. Yes, unfortunately, none of the manuscripts from the Women's Orchestra have survived. But there was this very poignant moment where the Women's Orchestra performed a piece for themselves, so in a secret performance in their barracks. And this was clearly a very memorable event, so much so that not just one, but actually at least two of the survivors were able to give incredibly detailed information about this arrangement of Chopin's Tristesse Etude with lyrics by Alma Rose, who was the conductor of the orchestra. So I was able to follow these instructions that these two survivors were able to remember. And then also I was able to cross-reference who was in the orchestra at that time to ascertain exactly what the instrumentation was, so that as close as possible in the documentary, we were able to perform this arrangement exactly as it was in Auschwitz.
You have recordings of survivors of Auschwitz, and it's very interesting what they say about the only way to survive, and still you might not survive in Auschwitz, was to be in a pair, to have a sister or some friend who you could just rely on come what may.
Indeed. And I think in a way, it's a point beyond that, which is that it was about if you gave up, then you left your partner and behind. And that would have been such an awful thing to do, that you needed the power and the will within yourself to support the other person. And I mean, it's the sort of thing that we just cannot begin to understand or appreciate. And neither do I really want to try and find the words to do it. But in this project, what I have tried to do is to try and express that through music. And I think this is where music can be so incredibly helpful, because music is, of course, an abstract art form. It cannot say specific words, but it does speak in emotion. And I think that that's what we can do in this documentary when we're dealing with the Holocaust, which is of such huge significance that it's impossible for us to boil it down to simple words.
Now, the music wasn't always positive, because one of the survivors talks about arriving at the camp and hearing the orchestra and foolishly for her, thinking it can't be all bad.
Yes, indeed. This is the case that many incoming prisoners did indeed hear an orchestra. This appears to be something that happened more by accident rather than by design, but it is certainly the case that many people arrived and they heard an orchestra and it gave them the impression that the camp maybe is not as bad as they thought it would be. And this just shows that music was actually a very vital part of the infrastructure in Auschwitz, which is, of course, a very distressing and disturbing reality. But that is the truth, and that is something that we have to reconcile.
Well, it's a wonderful documentary, and you can catch The Lost Music of Auschwitz on Sky Arts and Now TV on Monday, the 20th of January. Leo Geyer, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The programme tonight was researched by Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and the show was produced by Sinead Egan. And Fiachna O'Brien On is next.